Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started this afternoon. Feel free to continue to enjoy the lunch in the back. I'm certain that other people will be coming in and filling in as we begin. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS, and I want to welcome all of you for being with us today. This event this afternoon is a first for us, and we're really thrilled that we can do this, and we're thrilled that we can do this with the wonderful partners that are here with us today. And what started as a simple idea of a basis of discussion among the four or five partner organizations quickly triggered quite a bit of excitement and quite a bit of energy and creativity. And the one result is the program we have today, which is a very rich and quite interesting program, and one that really is pretty unprecedented for us as an institution, and we're very proud of that. And we're thrilled that we've been able to call upon the expertise and talent of our partners. We're the one campaign, Roxanne Filson and her colleagues, Gavi Alliance, Rhonda Stewart's here today, Alex Palacios and others. PATH, we've worked extensively with PATH over the last several years, and an organization that we much admire. Abby Weaver's with us here. UN Foundation Shot at Life, Peg Willingham, we've cooperated with over many years in many different very fruitful ways. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation will be joined today by Nicole Bates, who's come some distance to be with us, and Dan Green. I want to make a special mention and offer special thanks to Sandra DeCastro Buffington, who's come some distance from California, from USC, where she directs the Hollywood Health and Society program, and that brings a whole other outlook and perspective that I think is going to be really interesting addition to this. And thank you, Sandra, for coming and agreeing. We'll be joined this afternoon by Ambassador Mark Sterella. He happens to be here in town this week. For the second time in history, Secretary of State has called together all of the chiefs of mission worldwide for a meeting in Washington. It just happens to have fallen this week. And Mark has been a great friend and advocate, and as you'll see in the Zambia video where he figures, he's engaged and very much so. We're also joined by Alfred Chioza, the DCM from the Zambian Embassy, who will be with us speaking along with Mark, and Ben Chwanga from the embassy, who is so important in our moving forward our collaboration with the Zambian government on this video. The CSIS team, I want to single out Janet Fleischman, Seth Gannon, Emma Curran, Julia Nagel. That was the team that put the video together. They've been indefatigable. Julia is in Jordan this week and very much regrets she can't be with us, but deserves enormous credit along with the other members of the team. Janet was indefatigable at directing and moving things forward and conceptualizing this. There are a number of other folks you'll see today who have contributed significantly. John Donnelly's with us today, and he's a testament, I think, to the ability to adapt and convert to this environment here. He had a very distinguished career as a print journalist with the Boston Globe, and over the last several years has broadened his horizons and been very successful. And thank you, John, for being with us today and contributing. We'll also be joined later in the program by Amy Batson, the Deputy Assistant Administrator from USAID. She is a true leader in this field in global health policy and at USAID, and a very close friend. Why is CSIS interested in this work? There's a couple of reasons. One is that we're simply, in the last several years, there's been a big rush to become very active in this space. Not that we necessarily knew what we were doing at each point along the way, but there's an inexorable pull to move in and begin experimenting and to and to be active in this way. And today we're going to showcase a new product, which is the Zambia video, and we're very proud of that and very pleased with that. That follows on in our program two videos that we did put together on Kenya. All of the video work that we did during the commission, the CSIS Commission on Smart Global Health Policy in 2009 and 2010. But beyond that, within CSIS, there's been an explosion of our digital audience. Our digital, there's a new product that my colleague Don Morton has put together, which is going to be posted online shortly. It's a very nice little product. I have a few copies, but you can't really see much from here. But it does show that the digital audience from 07 was at about 70,000, 71,000 per month in 07. We're now running at 1.7 million per month. And that's a combination of podcasts and videos on iTunes. In 05, CSIS released 20 audio and video products online. In 2011, we released 886 products. So we're interested, and we're embedded, and this is becoming part of who we are, and it's becoming an embedded tool. As earlier I think I mentioned, we're learning as we move ahead, and today we're going to hopefully learn much more in the two panels, in the way those two panels have been configured. I want to say a few other things as to why. This is the video we find is a very powerful and compelling and vivid tool. It allows us to bring into our discussions the actual voices of the people that are the beneficiaries, the implementers, those that are doing the actual work. And that's much different than a secondary or tertiary personality interpreting what is happening. I know Janet's going to offer more insights in her remarks around what this all means. It extends our reach as an institution. Traditionally, CSIS is 50 years old. We have been traditionally a foreign policy and international security institution that caters to a core constituency inside the Beltway in the executive branch, congressional branch, media, advocacy, and other think tanks and independent experts. We've obviously discovered that that core constituency remains a core constituency, and many of those people themselves learn and absorb knowledge by the tools that we're going to be looking at today. But it's also important that we be extending our reach. The interested audiences who strive to know more and have access to knowledge are well outside of those boundaries that I laid down. And we're discovering that, in fact, the uptake, the appetite, the market is a very strong market, and that many people are learning perhaps in the first instance, they're putting their toe in the water and engaging some sense of whether they want to go further. Moving in this field does not diminish necessarily the power and value of our analytic printed work and the value of the convening of small groups and large groups and the public discussions, but it gives us another tool that can be both a gateway tool to move people towards other products that they may not be familiar with, but it also can be a tool that, in fact, educates and in and of itself becomes very valuable in that. We're in a competitive environment here in Washington. As you know, within the Washington, D.C. area, there are over 200 think tanks of varying sizes, from suitcase size to 10-story size. The field of institutions of our size and scope are half a dozen or slightly more than that here in D.C. It's important that we all be excelling and refining these tools and learning from people like Sandra and others who are working them from another perspective and another set of expertise but have much to tell us and to share with us. We're in a period right now, we're in a difficult period from the standpoint of global health policy. We're in a very difficult period in which we've come off of a decade of remarkable expansion of resources and commitment and leadership, and now we're in a period of flat and contracting resource base and enormous uncertainty and anxiety and heightened scrutiny and questioning around the value and the impacts of these investments. And this tool, this set of tools, I believe, are ever more important in making the case to the American public in an honest and credible way. And I include in that congressional staff and congressional members, and other media, other members of the media. I do think there's a lot more work that we need to do looking forward to try and answer some of the tough questions. We've had this amazing experience with the Coney video that showed, that set off this big debate, and I won't go into too much about that, but there is, of course, a continued concern. By moving into this domain, we do not give up the standards of rigor and factual basis that have to guide. There's no loosening of standards as we move forward. However, the way in which those standards are applied and the way in which they are verified becomes in some ways more difficult and more complex. We as an institution always walk a line of access to policymakers on the Hill and the executive branch and having an independent critical edge. And we have, if we're moving into this domain, we cannot sacrifice our critical edge in order to have access. And when you're carrying cameras around or when you're having a heavier duty, more in a set of interventions, that in itself leads to a different kind of negotiated access. I think our products, I'm very proud of our products, and I think they're very affirmative and very informative and very powerful. They don't have a very sharp critical edge to them. And as we look to the future, we need to be asking ourselves, is it possible to introduce a sharper and more critical edge to them? We've debated among ourselves, do we have the skills and the training that are necessary to be really effective and professional in this field? As I said, we've thrown these things together. We've called on outside expertise. Blue State Digital has been terribly important in the evolution of our capacities. Joe Rospers, Stephen Mueller have been terribly important to us. But we're moving to an internal capacity. We are moving to be able to execute projects, not just in our program, but as a center. And we've done this on an incremental basis without really stepping back and asking, okay, what over a 5 or 10 year plan, what do we need in terms of training and expertise? And I include in that diplomatic training because, as I say, much of this is around getting people to be trusting and open and accessible to these kinds of new things. Lastly, we have to think hard, long and hard, about how we evaluate the impacts and the investments needed. You'll see this Zambia video is very powerful and high quality. It also rested upon an enormous investment of time and energy, and we can't do this on a routine monthly basis. This is something that was done. We will certainly repeat and have more and more of these, but we have to be looking and evaluating more carefully the value and how we manage this, but also what's the impact. You know, how is this consumed? How do we change those audiences? And I know these are issues that the professionals in this field struggle with all the time, and those partners that have put other products together today will be discussing. So I just wanted to share with you some of those thoughts. We are very excited about this. We're very grateful to all of you, and especially to our partners who are here today. I just want to invite our first panel, Peg Willingham from Shot at Life, UN Foundation, will be chairing that panel, and we'll be introducing everyone. So I'd just like to invite our other panelists to come forward. So please join me in welcoming them. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, and thank you all for being here today. And many thanks to CSAS for organizing this really innovative event. You can see that we have, I think, a record crowd, as well as a lot of people watching online, both around the country and internationally. And, of course, it's online viewers that we're excited about today, as well as you all in person. So thank you. And we always know when we come to CSAS that we're going to learn something. And today we're doing that, but also learning and sharing about how to communicate in a new way with these new media. As Steve mentioned, the focus of this first panel is how organizations like ours can convey certain messages to targeted audience for impact. And we want to figure out what storylines will educate people and, more importantly, motivate people to take action around the causes that we all advocate and champion. And so advocates are storytellers. You know, if you're someone who's lobbying Congress or if you're trying to reach out to grassroots, you have to tell a story that people can relate to. And frankly, it's more likely they'll do that than if you tell them a lot of statistics. A challenge that we have as vaccine advocates, though, is that people don't tend to think a lot about prevention. And prevention isn't as easy to measure, and it doesn't, you know, you're trying to prove a negative that you made something not happen. And while I think most people recognize that vaccines are amazing life-saving tools, they're really taken for granted. And nobody wakes up and says, you know, I didn't get measles today because of that great vaccine that my parents got when I was a baby 40-some years ago. So that's the challenge that we have to overcome as vaccine advocates and storytellers. How do you get people to care about something like this? Like any good film festival, audience participation will be very important today, and we're leaving a lot of time after each panel. Oh, thank you. For Q&A. So we look forward to having you all tell us after you see our videos if we actually have succeeded in conveying these messages and storylines. One thing I should mention, by the way, that in any kind of an event like this about social media, we hope that people are tweeting and retweeting. And the hashtag today is @VaxFilmFest, V-A-X FilmFest, one word. And speaking of which, a job that didn't exist a few years ago at our organizations is something very important to our own campaign at Shot at Life. It is our social media leader, and I'm glad that my colleague Elise is here today live tweeting away, and that's something that I wouldn't have even known what that was not too long ago. So please tweet and retweet at @VaxFilmFest. So I have the privilege to lead the Shot at Life campaign, which is an awareness and advocacy and fundraising campaign whose mission is to work with a lot of partners, many of you are here today, to create a movement of Americans who will care about and contribute to and advocate for global immunizations for children who need them the most. So to kick off the panel, we want to show you today the Shot at Life campaign video, just to give you an overview. And what we hope you'll do is figure out what audience we were trying to reach. And also, there's a bonus question if you can identify the movie from which the music came from. So, without further ado, the Shot at Life campaign video. So I look forward to hearing what you think. But my colleagues and I joke that, you know, speaking of a target audience, that our goal for this video was to make grown men cry because a distinguished vaccine researcher told us that the video had made him cry, so we thought that was good. But then his wife ruined it by telling us that he cries all the time about everything. So But we did have another target audience in mind, and I just wanted to briefly describe the process of how we developed this video. So when we first started to create the campaign with generous support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation over a year ago, every public affairs and communications firm who bid on this job had a short pilot video to show us, because they made it clear that you just, for any advocacy effort like this, you needed to have a video. And so the video that you just saw was the work of the great creative team at APCO Worldwide and Ann Sabolt and Jim Quinlan. Jim is here today. They came up with the video with the color, with the font, with every piece of creative that you saw. And, of course, we had our input, but it was really their vision, which we were really happy to be a part of. But first, we did a lot of research. APCO has an excellent research team that looked at original research that said that mothers of young children would have been the most likely target audience, because they make the healthcare decisions, they make the purchasing decisions, generally speaking. They tend to take children to the doctor, they make the philanthropy decisions. And I think you all probably know this, but women outnumber men online, on Facebook, on Twitter. So that was also been a key component of the campaign. So APCO confirmed all this, though, by doing research with about 2,000 Americans, parents of young children of different ages and demographic backgrounds, both in-person and online surveys, and that really confirmed our belief that we should try to aim primarily towards mothers of young children. But our goal, of course, is to get all Americans to care about vaccines as well. And you'll see, I think you've seen that our goal was to be positive while still conveying the urgency of the need, and to show these universal moments of childhood that you saw, that the children in developing countries who need vaccines are really not so different from the children in our own lives. Because, so I think you all know, for good or for bad, people have to be motivated to take action by feeling that they have some connection to it. I'm sure you also have all seen research, this is something Nicholas Kristof has talked about, that when people hear about a mass disaster that affect a lot of people, it's very hard to relate, and we tend to kind of look away, and that the number of people that you can relate to is only one person's story. So we talk about how one child dies every 20 seconds, and that's sort of, you know, shaped the way we try to pick every word and image to really resonate and be based on research. So in addition to the visuals, we did want music that would galvanize people. And so, you know, for the bonus round, I don't know if anyone can guess the violent Quentin Tarantino movie that this came from that really has nothing to do with vaccines. Rachel did guess. I'm so sorry, Roxanne, forgive me.
That's all right.
So Roxanne guessed is True Romance. But this is music that Jim had always hoped to use in a video, and APCO got but for good purpose, because as you could tell, as it picks up, as you see what are the moments of childhood we want to get children to experience when they get vaccines. So the Academy Award and other award-winning composer Hans Zimmer, through Morgan Creek Productions, gave us the rights to use this pro bono, which we really appreciated. So I want to turn it over to Roxanne and my other panelists. But, you know, someone did tell us recently they liked our video because it talked about the value of vaccines without preaching and without bombarding the viewer with statistics. But a question we hope you all will think about, and that the panelists I may ask about, is how do you balance emotion with information? Because we do also have to educate, and you'll be seeing these videos as well. So, again, it's my honor to turn it over to Roxanne Filson from the One Campaign. I know that you all know that One's mission is to focus on poverty and preventable disease in the poorest places of the world. And Roxanne has worked in the development field on communications and campaigning for over 10 years at places like Oxfam and Data. And until recently, she was the global campaign director for One based in London, but has moved here to Washington last year and is their global creative director. So, Roxanne.
Thank you very much, Peg. And thank you very much to CSIS for having us here today. I think it's going to be a really interesting day. So for those of you who don't know One, we're an advocacy and campaigning organization with over 3 million members dedicated to the fight against extreme poverty and preventable disease with a focus on Africa. I want to preface the videos that we're going to show with a little bit about what we've learned about storytelling in One in the past couple of years. So in 2010, we decided to sort of look at how we were telling stories in One and try and improve the way that we did that. We undertook a little bit of research, both in the US and in some of the European capitals. I think it was Berlin, Paris, and London. And we tested some real videos with people and got their feedback on them. And it was really fascinating, actually. And there were sort of four criteria that people really wanted to see in those stories. They wanted to see people empowering individuals to help themselves, to create sustainable change with lasting sort of leave-behinds, to represent a sort of self-consciously new type of aid, and that relates to the sort of lasting aid, and, yeah, that things wouldn't be one-off successes. So that was really useful research for us to inform our storytelling. But more than that, the most important thing that we learned from that research was that most of the people in the room said they never would have watched the videos in the first place. So while they liked what they saw and, you know, gave us tips on how we could improve it, they were like, I'm never going to watch this video anyway because I won't get to it. It just doesn't reach me where I'm at. So that was kind of the biggest challenge, was not actually how we put together great creative, but actually how we reach people with it. So that's something I really want to touch on today. Obviously, our focus is on vaccines, and last year, one, along with loads of people in this room and on this panel, ran a very big vaccines campaign towards the Gavi replenishment meeting in London last summer. We made it a top-tier priority within our organisation, which is very important in terms of creative development for us. Our goal was to campaign for multi-year funding commitments to Gavi. We drilled down to a very simple top-line message of save 4 million children over the next 5 years, which is critical to getting to the message across, and you'll see that pop up in our communications. We knew that for us, we needed to engage hundreds of thousands of people in this campaign to have the kind of impact that we wanted, and that to do that, we needed to use sort of new creative models. What I'm going to share with you today is two really different approaches that we used and what we learned from that for our work with film and creative going forward. So the first case study is called Voodoo and Vaccines, which is kind of weird from the get-go, but this was primarily aimed for us to reach new audiences. And in order to do that, we decided to work with a really unusual partner, a sort of production and a digital company called Vice. You may have seen them online. They're responsible for producing some pretty edgy content, but they have a huge digital audience that trends very young. And we really wanted to go for, like, can we reach these people or not? And actually trends male, which is, you know, often a challenge for us. So we worked with them on a mini documentary, and I'm going to show you the trailer for that. That's okay, Seth.
La médecine traditionnelle a sa place et la médecine moderne a sa place aussi. C'est vraiment difficile. En Afrique, le problème des médecines.
Déjà, il y a un mythe qui est autour de la vaccination dans la vallée de Niamey ici, qu'on est en train de vacciner l'enfant et...
The first big problem is the fact that children are dying young.
C'est vrai que pour le moment, on n'a pas encore le pneumo. Mais à nos réunions, le vaccin contre le pneumo est annoncé.
In the year 2011, you can actually prevent these things.
There are some religious groups that are resistant to that kind of Western things.
S'il n'y a pas de vaccination, ce serait la catastrophe. Et ce serait suicidaire.
Most of the people who talk about Africa will follow the government. If you don't meet the right person who will really tell you what's the meaning of this? You go back with your first knowledge and go and tell the whole world that you have seen this.
La médecine moderne a sa compétence, mais ça a déjà une limite.
So we wanted to use, you know, the interest around voodoo as a sort of Trojan horse to kind of get people engaged in the whole argument about vaccines. And, you know, it was very successful in doing that. We got 645,000 online views via the Vice player to audiences that I don't think we would ever normally reach with this. We did French, German, US, and UK English versions. And we also, like, built in a petition so that if you stopped the video anywhere during it or at the end, it automatically popped up with our petition action. So it took you directly to what we wanted you to do, to sign up to one and to sign up to this important campaign. We didn't put any effort into broadcast for this piece, but it was shared on more than 150 different sites, including the CNN homepage and things like Le Monde in France. So it did get sort of a lot of digital reach. I would say some of the downsides were that the conversion was low. So I'm going to show you a different piece, which had lower number of views, but the people that viewed tend to sort of convert to the campaign more. But it did bring in a whole new audience. 90% of the people that signed up as a result of this were new members to One, which is really important for us. I will say that, you know, it didn't come without a cost. It is a warts and all kind of story, actually. It's very honest. And that we actually tested that side of it because our internal teams were very, very nervous about this piece. And so we did a little bit of testing before we released it. And what we actually found, we tested it against a couple of other pieces of creative. In terms of believability, it got a 94.5% believability rating, which is pretty extraordinary. And I think what it showed is that actually, when you do tell a more complex, more difficult story about these things, people find that more credible, actually. So that was fascinating. It was challenging working with Vice. They were amazing, but they don't have development as a background. So trying to sort of infuse that piece with the right messages, you know, it was some work. And as I said, internally, it was a challenge because, you know, we wanted to get the right policy messages across, but equally we wanted to make a compelling story that people would want to watch. So the second case study that I'm going to kind of compare and contrast was something called Why Bother? And this was like your more traditional, like family-friendly PSA type approach to this. And we wanted to get broadcast pickup with it and to reach the kind of already engaged public and influencers that we were trying to target directly. It was also based on some research findings that we'd had recently, which was a messaging finding that if you combine two things, first of all, the fact that foreign assistance is a really small proportion of our overall budget, 1% or less than 1%. If you combine that piece of information with the living proof that these programs are smart programs are saving lives, that those two things together actually have the power to shift people in this debate and to move them from being real aid skeptics to actually getting behind foreign assistance. And so part of the sort of narrative of this piece is based on that research that we did. So if we can just show that piece.
I've got my own problems to worry about. Those people in Africa don't want to help themselves.
It's their mess. Why should I care?
Their problems are too big to solve.
Stop wasting my hard-earned money.
Hey, I'm as compassionate as the next guy.
But it's like throwing money down a rat hole.
Nothing will ever change.
I give up.
I give up.
I give up.
What's the point?
Where's the proof?
Actually, smart programs are saving lives. In just 10 years, over 15 million more kids are alive. And over 46 million more kids are in school.
All for less than 1%.
1%. 1% of the total U.S. budget.
How's that for proof?
And today there are new vaccines that could save millions of more kids. But it won't happen without you. Go to One.org and join the movement. Add your voice to over 2 million One members around the world. We're not asking for your money. We're asking for your voice.
So we did 60-second, 30-second versions of that in US English, British English, and French. It got over 200,000 online views, but also more than 336 million broadcast impressions. It generated at least 1.5 million in media value. It was aired on ABC, NBC, blah, 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 lots of stations. One of the most innovative things we did, actually, was to empower our volunteers with the tapes to take into their local stations and to ask the stations to play them as a sort of lobby activity to the stations. And that was actually really successful. So I'd really encourage people to think about that in terms of distribution. It got 60 media mentions and a load of celebrity and social media, which was great. In terms of the overall campaign, we got over 300,000 petition signers. And then we also did sort of more innovative things than we've done before with our social media. So we got over 3,000 tweets directed at the White House as part of the campaign, and actually over 1,000 calls to the White House in 1 week on the campaign, which I think really kind of registered with them. Our members had over 182 meetings with members of Congress. More importantly than all of that, as many of you will know, many of you were part of, this campaign was successful. The US met its target pledge of $450 million over 3 years. And European donor contributions met, I think, 80% of all new pledges. And we're also very grateful to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for, you know, providing that $1 billion pledge, which really, like, catalyzed other people to get involved. So all that being said, actually the most profound learning from all of this wasn't the two different creative approaches, but was how we often as creatives think about our creative first, like what's the video I want to make, what's the messaging that we want in that. And now we've just turned that right around to say, how are we going to get people to see this video? How is it going to get distributed? Is it online? Is it broadcast? Who will carry it? Who will promote it? Very interesting thing from the F-Famine campaign, which obviously is a different issue, but this was a big campaign we ran last year also, is we produced a very specific cut for Fox, which had people from Fox in it, and they carried it and promoted it because it was a Fox version of our PSA. So that's useful to know. Obviously, we need to be much more social by design. She loves it so much, she's watching it again. That's great. We need to think about how people are sharing these things and using them, and having action built in is really important, because it's no good for us, to be quite honest, if you just watch a video. I mean, it's good that you're getting to know the issues, but we really want you to act and do something about it. So having that conversion built in. Urgency helps, but it means you need to be able to move fast. So with this famine campaign we ran, we created 12 versions of that PSA in 3 languages in 1 month. But that takes a huge amount of trust from an organization in creative ability and investment. And I think that's really important to point out, is the best creative is often around a certain moment. And to make that happen in large organizations is tough. So I'd really encourage organizations to get behind their creative teams on that. Social sharing with artists and influencers has been really useful to us. Interestingly, Bill Gates shared one of our PSAs last year, and his share converted most members to the campaign. Kim Kardashian did share the same PSA. She got a lot of views, but not the same number of conversions, perhaps unsurprisingly. But, you know, you need to hit all of those things. And then just 2 last points and I'll finish. One is that with the social media stuff, you need an ongoing conversation, which I'm sure everyone's aware about. But we invest in, you know, our Facebook account and our Twitter followers, you know, every single day, which means that when we release stuff like that, we've already got these networks to get things out. And, you know, you need to send... if people get something from someone they trust, from a friend, if they get sent something, they're much, much more likely to watch it. So creating things that are shareable are really important. And, you know, there's a lot of increasing research on why we share something, but your intuition is generally right on this. People either want the respect of others, or they want to create a sense of belonging. So look at your own motivations for why you share something and then apply that to your creative work, and you'll probably be right. People want to look smart, they want to look funny, they want to look cool. So that's what our creative needs to increasingly be, not a small challenge. Thank you.
Roxanne, thank you. So it was smart, funny, and cool. I think everyone would agree these are great videos. And one is also very good about sharing, sharing other people's content as well. For people who are coming in now, just a reminder, speaking of social media, that the hashtag is VaxFilmFest. So I now want to present Abby Weaver, who is the Policy Communications Officer at PATH. And I think that most, if not every person here, knows that PATH is an international nonprofit organization that is dedicated to transforming global health through innovation, and that includes inventing new vaccines and making existing vaccines work better in developing countries. And the story that she's going to tell you is one of the most exciting global health breakthroughs in the last year, and it's great that more people will learn about it today. So, Abby, thank you.
Good afternoon. I won't give away the full story. I want to just leave you with a little teaser and allow you to hear the story through the video. So I'm honored to be able to share with you a particular historic and important moment, not only for PATH, but for global health. And that moment was when the first vaccine was introduced into Africa. It was specifically designed for Africa, and it reached there before any other continent. So with that tease, we'll start the video.
La méningite constitue un sérieux problème de santé publique.
This is a problem people know because they've experienced it in their immediate families.
It's the personal problems that accrue to every family and every individual that has this disease.
It is life or death.
We almost never talk to somebody who hadn't been affected.
If we can end this, this is a big deal.
December 6, 2010 was one of the most important milestones in public health. We began the introduction of the meningitis vaccine within Burkina Faso, and soon after that, within a week, within Mali and Niger.
It was really exciting to see the first children get their immunizations. They are going to be one of the first generations to live without the fear of this disease.
There was a sense of great excitement there. And there was also a lot of pageantry.
The president gave a speech and talked about the importance of this new vaccine. And then teams were all over the country getting the vaccine out.
It's an incredible moment in public health. It's taken us about 9 years since the project began, and that's relatively short in the scope of pharmaceutical development. So being able to get through that whole process and to launch the vaccine marks an incredible historic occasion.
This was a massive public health effort between the World Health Organization, PATH, the Serum Institute, partners all over the world.
One of the first things that we did after we received the grant was to consult with African public health leaders from the meningitis belt. And they had one clear message for us. If you don't make it affordable, you might as well not do it at all. So we did that. We've developed a vaccine at a target price of less than 50 cents a dose.
It's a major event. In fact, we hope it's a sea change.
We often take for granted the benefits of vaccine-preventable disease. Because we have the vaccines, we don't have the disease. So the value of this vaccine was widely known, widely recognized. When we were planning for it, we said, how will we make sure people come out? And the Burkina Ministry of Health official said, that's not going to be a problem.
People were coming from all directions to get in line to get vaccine.
And sure enough, at the end of the day, we had 97-98% coverage of the populations that needed the vaccine in an entire country. It is the end of the development of the vaccine. We have developed a safe, effective vaccine at an affordable price and launched it with 20 million people. But that's just the beginning.
From here, we have a long way to go. We need to introduce the vaccine in the other meningitis belt countries. We need to make sure that the people who need it get it.
For all of West Africa and the rest of the meningitis belt, this is hope squared, hope cubed in terms of eliminating this particular problem. This is a big deal.
This is a slightly different video than the ones that you saw earlier, and our purpose was very different. We wanted to document, from an implementing organization's point of view, a very historic event. And so we had a lot more information to convey, but we still wanted to make sure that there was emotion, so we had to balance that. And we also had a lot of different stakeholders that we wanted to share this story with. We had donors, we had social media users, we had traditional informed web users. We had our partners and our staff and people around the world who are suffering from this disease. And so our solution to that was to make three different videos. So the video that you've seen here in the middle is the midpoint. But I want to first start talking about our most successful video, which is surprisingly the longest video. But where it won't surprise you, it is the one that contains the most personal stories and that really demonstrates the human toll that this disease has taken. So we developed a video of 12 minutes, and we shared it at an annual fundraising event. And it was full of emotional stories, a woman whose three daughters had become deaf because of the disease and how they were coping with that and how their neighbors, once they received the vaccine, weren't going to have to suffer that same fate. We received tons of requests to see that video, but many people didn't have the time to watch a 12-minute video. So we prepared a kind of a medium length, which you've just seen here. And the target audience for this video really was our most informed partners and informed web users. The people that come to PATH's websites are usually informed about our work, informed about global health, and they're just looking for more information, some credible evidence, and the detail that they need to talk about these causes. We also created a very short version in partnership with the One Campaign in the Living Proof Project. And this video really was meant to translate and combine both the information and the emotion into a very short version, less than 3 minutes, that could be played on social media. And this is something that featured some of the stories. It had more rapid music. The music came much earlier in the production of the video, and we're really excited to see how that performs online. We could have spent a lot more time in developing this video talking about our process. We could have talked about how the vaccine was developed, because that's what we do best. We could have talked about our institutional processes and what it really takes. But that was very personal to PATH, and it doesn't allow others to celebrate this accomplishment. And so we wanted to focus on what was really important, was that shared accomplishment of reaching people and protecting them against this disease. So our tone was really meant to be celebratory. It was meant to be a catalyst and to really forecast a world without meningitis. That's
great. Thank you, Abby. Well, our next speaker comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and you all know that their mission is to work to help all people lead healthy and productive lives. And our guest today, Dan Green, is the Foundation's Media and Information Grants Manager. His title is the Deputy Director of Strategic Partnerships. And prior to joining the Foundation about a little over a year ago, Dan was the Senior Vice President at Homefront Communications. And he launched the Content Project, which is a division of the company designed to help nonprofits and foundations tell their own stories, which is what we're here to talk about today. And as part of that project, he helped design and manage content creation for the Living Proof Project, which many of you are familiar with, another great video and advocacy project. And before that, Dan spent more than 10 years, 17 years at ABC News, and 12 of those with Nightline as a producer and senior producer, so he has really spent his career in telling stories. So we look forward to his perspective. Dan, thank you.
Hi, thanks very much, and thanks for having me. So just as a bit of background to set my situation up, I'm not actually now in the creative direction or the storytelling part of the foundation. I manage a new grant-making portfolio that really helps support others to tell stories. By and large, and I've inherited quite a few grants, just to give a bit of background, most of those grants are to news media organizations. So one of the things, and I'm going to take the discussion in a slightly different way just to talk about it. In the past year, I've had an enormous opportunity to meet around the world with a lot of publishers, editors, people in news media organizations to kind of hear what they're looking for, what they're thinking about, their efforts around storytelling. And I wanted to have a chance to touch on this because one of the areas that's an enormous opportunity, there are opportunities obviously in this current landscape and there are challenges, but there's an enormous opportunity in the changing media landscape for obviously organizations like ours to tell stories directly to audiences rather than necessarily try to constantly pitch these stories through news organizations, particularly news organizations that are often strained on resources, particularly strained on resources in the developing world. But a couple of things I wanted to share with in terms of some lessons. And there's three things I wanted to touch on. The things that I've talked over the past year with a lot of these organizations is a little bit of how they're thinking about their storytelling efforts. The other is about how they're thinking about engaging their audiences or their users. And the third area that I just quickly want to touch on is how they're thinking about data. And there are three interesting challenges and opportunities. The first thing that has come across very clearly and from my time, and so I'm speaking now as someone who worked for a long time in the news business, we brought together a group of media professionals to the foundation about a month ago from around the world, and what's quite clear is these kinds of stories are to many news organizations kind of considered the broccoli of news. As Ian Katz from The Guardian said, this is real eat your peas stuff. And so you need to remember when you're trying to figure out why are news organizations not just gravitating to my vaccine story, it's clearly not what drives audiences as much as the Kim Kardashian stories do, no doubt, or the Royals or anything else. And I was sitting on a panel recently with Don McNeil of the New York Times, which is one organization that actually dedicates real resources to global health. And even Don said, you know, whenever he's walking up to the editorial desk, he could see their eyes roll and go, here comes Don now. With some story about people dying in some place. And so, you know, he said it's not easy. So those are real challenges, but there are some real opportunities. One is most media organizations over the past year or so who've done their own research about their audiences get a consistent message, and the consistent message seems to be their audiences are getting a little too depressed at some of their stories and would also like to hear what are the solutions to some of these problems. Which is good news, because there was always this sense of if kind of it bleeds, it leads, and all the good news is really no news. So there are a lot of organizations that are thinking about how they're going to begin to tell stories that actually include solutions and progress and doesn't leave everybody with this sense of, oh, this is an intractable problem. So that's great. The challenge, obviously, for some of these folks is making it relevant for folks. It's back to a bit of the broccoli problem. And so you get a regular, as Don and anybody who's tried to pitch these stories, you get a little bit of a so what, why now, why should people care, which makes some of this stuff challenging. I think that when some of these folks have talked about it, and Nick Kristoff, as you mentioned, I think is an important example, there are a lot of people that have kind of gone back and said storytelling really matters, making these stories truly compelling. Which is true. And there have been a lot of people writing about, so what makes a great story? And Nick Kristoff has written about, obviously, there's two factors that are essential if you're trying to use these stories to help better market your issues. One is that they're personal. They're about a person, as you mentioned. The other is that they're hopeful. So good. Those both actually very much fit. But as you talk to more folks in media, you also sense that there's a lot more to it than that. It's a lot more challenging than that. And there have been a lot of people that you probably heard of out there who've been talking about what are some of these common denominators? Is there a secret sauce for great storytelling? Does it have to have certain things in it? And there's Andy Goodman is a guy who actually does seminars on helping nonprofits and advocacy organizations to tell better stories and talks about how that has to have a conflict and an element of tension, and it has to have a simple message and all that kind of stuff. There's a person, Ian Inaba, who works at the Citizen Engagement Laboratory, who does a lot of work with advocacy organizations, who says you have to work very carefully on the narrative. With about that narrative, to him, is about an individual. What they've seen is individuals who show courage or bravery. People want to find leaders. People want to see someone who's done something that they aspire to. And so he often says, look for those people who have shown some degree of courage or bravery, find it, and figure out how to tell about it. So there's lots of those things. And lots of people have talked about them. I mean, and even in, probably you've seen the book Made to Stick by the Heath Brothers, and they go through a lot of it. And they even talk about the fact, which is true, that stories have to have something in them that's kind of surprising and unexpected. And so when you pitch stories, generally, people want to know what's the counterintuitive part of it. What is the, God, I didn't know that. Wow, that's different. And I would just encourage all of us to think about how you address the skeptic audience with the so what, why should I care now, with thinking about what can you do that would actually surprise them that's unexpected as well as personal. And obviously I think it is a good point to talk about people who have courage and bravery and overcome that. And in the end, I think that what, out of even studying all these things, and even when we were inside, when I was inside Nightline for years, and I worked overseas in South Africa in the Bureau when HIV and AIDS started to become a real problem, we had worked a long time covering these stories, a long time, and we had spent a lot of time covering it. And I just wanted to tell you one story that really stood out and ended up getting a lot of people to gravitate to was a story that's a little old for most of you, about a boy named Nkosi Johnson. And so a great writer named Jim Wooten found this 10-year-old boy named Nkosi Johnson in South Africa. He ended up speaking at the conference in 2000. And it was just an example of how a single story ended up catapulting our audiences to say, we'd like to know more about him. And it was a story he was nine, I think, at the time, 9 and 10. Jim Wooten did a story, and it was a story about one boy who had HIV and wanted to go to school like everyone else. And it was this remarkable little tale of one boy who wanted to go to school and how he was being treated when his mother took him to school. And it was an extraordinary story of bravery and courage. It was surprising how people reacted. It was an amazing tale. Nelson Mandela ended up finally hearing about this story and met with him. When we put that story on, there was such an outpouring of reaction to his story that we ended up doing 3 different nightlines on him because people kept saying, what's happened to Nkosi? What's happened to Nkosi? Jim Wooten ended up writing a book called We Are All the Same, which turned out to be a huge seller. And Jim Wooten was considered one of the best TV writers and a former New York Times writer. And even he admitted that often it's you just find a great, compelling individual. And so one of the things that I used to do when I was at Homefront is go to organizations that I'd be working with, and I would say it in the most simplest way, saying, we're looking for your rock stars, right? We're looking for who is the one person you would tell your family about over Thanksgiving. That's kind of why you do what you do. Those are hard things to find. And I can tell you that media organizations are always looking for that great personal story. Those are the things that they want. The other thing I think that's important, and all of these videos have been incredible, is obviously authenticity matters. It was raised early. The credibility and the authenticity is absolutely essential. I think that what our organizations have an incredible capacity to talk directly to media organizations, and they do look at our sites and they do look for stories. But we're in a special place where authentic, credible stories that bring them information they otherwise would not have resonate. They don't have people on the ground in these locations. When I worked at ABC News, there was, and I worked overseas in South Africa in 1990, there was 12, I think, full-time staff people in Johannesburg. There's no bureau in South Africa. There's no bureau in Africa at the moment for ABC News. So they're in a much different environment. So it gives you guys, and it gives all of us, an enormous opportunity. The other thing I just quickly wanted to touch on, 2 other factors, and Roxy touched on it, and it's come up many times with media organizations, in that it's seen a lot by many media organizations now, a lot like The Guardian, The New York Times, and others are talking about a kind of 3-legged approach to some of their storytelling. It's the stories, it's engagement, figuring out ways that people can engage with the information, and the third is data. And there is this exploding area and attention towards what's called data journalism. It used to be kind of called computer-assisted reporting. Google is supporting it with now the first time ever award for data journalism. A lot of journalism schools are talking about teaching people about data. It's an enormous opportunity in that our organizations have great data. It doesn't necessarily mean you flood your stories and your videos with data, but giving people the opportunity to go look at the data, interact with the data, when they find out about these things, which is see more about the data when. USA Today, someone at USA Today told me that they once did a bit of research that said 80% of their online traffic was to their data visualization and their interactive data tools. And then when they actually went and delved further into it, what they noticed was if the data was interactive and people could actually play with it and see how would this affect this factor, that's what really most of the traffic was driven to. The New York Times has seen it with their Balance the Budget tool and all kinds of things that they've done. When they put interactive data up there, they've noticed that people will gravitate to it. So as you give people an opportunity to engage with an individual story, if your organization also thinks a lot about what the data is, there are media organizations that also would love to get their hands on the data sets, and there's very powerful data about vaccines that you should feel that a lot of media organizations are now not so much saying, I just want the one fact, which is a child dies every 3 seconds, but what does the data really tell us about where and what has impact? And so those are the kinds of things. So those three areas, and that second area of engagement is finding ways, the other thing that their research is telling them at media organizations, and I just wanted to throw this in, is people are feeling time constrained. Right? So respect your audience's time. Always think respectfully about their time. Every one of these media organizations knows that what their audience is telling them is, I'm overwhelmed. How can you really narrow this down for me to make sure I get the essence of what this is? Obviously, you get into that concern of we don't want to oversimplify, but we do want to engage people, and we do want to make it understandable, and we do want to really respect their time. So what they're talking a lot about is if we think about the engagement platform, so that last area of engagement I'd just like to say is, as Roxy pointed out on distribution is essential, and I think that, and the kind of stuff that One has been doing, engagement is absolutely essential. What some people are saying is, what people want to know is, so now what do I do? MIT is studying the area of participatory media, because what they know is everybody is saying, I want to participate in this process. The Guardian now, when it wakes up in the morning, puts out on their website, here are all the stories we're thinking about covering. If you have expertise in this area, or you would like to let us know, or you actually are someone who's actually got strong opinions about these stories, let us know now. And they have a whole community department that wants to figure out a way to get you to participate in this. So every one of these media organizations are thinking about engagement. And so a lot of people with every one of these things, when Roxy said you stop the video, you have a way to engage, I think that we should all be thinking about that, which is how are we actually taking the energy that you build, the emotion that you build when you show a video, and turning that into some action? That you think about, what is it now that I want people to do? Even when we were at Nightline, there were times when we would show stories that were just heart-wrenching, and we'd say, we can't just leave people with that. That's depressing. Right? And then you're going to say, thanks for joining us. I hope you have a good night. See you tomorrow night. And people are just in a pool on their couch. And we used to start thinking about, but we're a news organization. We can't. And so our partnership with ABC News was an interesting one as well, because they began to delve into the area of leading people to go to our site if you want to know what you can do to help. But I think all of us should be thinking about what action do we want people to take? Where can we make this engage? And what role could we have our users, our audience, our community play in contributing to this conversation?
Thank you. Well, I think that speaking of respecting time, we all got so excited telling you our stories that we have eaten into your Q&A time. And for that, we apologize. But we do want to hear from you. And what I would ask is, I think we'd like to take maybe the first three questions, and then we'll try to respond as quickly as possible and then get to the next round. So please, we'll start. I believe that there's folks with microphones will be coming around. So right here, the first person. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Carola Vile with USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I was very interested to hear all of your presentations, but I wonder how much of this applies outside of the United States. It seems to me, certainly from my own experience overseas, that we live in a highly individualized society, both in terms of how we receive news, how we engage with this kind of information. Do you think, perhaps Roxanne in particular, and Dan, if you can speak to that from your experiences, does the same process and message and ideas that you have put forward now hold true if you're trying to appeal to audiences in Europe or Eastern Europe or South Africa or anywhere else in the world? Thank you.
Thank you. Another question? There's someone up front, but we don't have you. You're not near a microphone. Oh, no, you are. Here we go.
Tammy Holtman from All Africa, and I just wanted to raise a question with Roxanne about the whether you're concerned about the image of Africa and Africans that's portrayed in the video, the first one that you showed. I mean, when you have something like 92% of Kenyans using mobile phones, for example, and 72% of unbanked Kenyans outside the capital of Nairobi living on less than $1.25 a day, who actually use M-Pesa mobile wallets. I'm wondering if incorporating some of the counter-stereotypical views of Africans would be maybe less believable to your audience. I mean, I'm not surprised that there was that high visibility because it seems to me to play to the stereotypes, but ultimately more interesting and surprising and productive.
Thank you. Is there one more question? Yeah, David.
Hi, I'm David Rubenstein with the Best Shot Foundation. I want to thank you very much for being up here. And maybe it happened too recently for this to really get into your coverage, and the smile suggests that you all know what my question is. So without even telling the question, I'm going to say, what do you think they got right? What do you think they got wrong? And what are the positive and negative lessons we should learn from the thing that I won't say?
I was hoping I would get a dollar for every time someone referred to the Joseph Kony video. I know we have one more question, but why don't we start with these? I know that the PATH video, just our second questioner had a great question about portrayal of Africa. The PATH video does have someone talk about people who aren't African telling African stories, and I think that was a very interesting theme. But the questions were, how does this work outside the U.S., portrayal of people in Africa, and what did the Kony video get right and wrong? So I'll just turn it over to the other panelists. Thanks.
You can go first. They're mostly at you.
So the first question about do these kinds of stories work outside of the U.S. where it's more individualized nation perhaps in some ways. I'd go back to the research that we conducted in 2010 where we tested all of these different videos and a couple of really interesting things. As a European, I came here and I'm like, I'm going to have to learn to tell stories differently. The creative approach is going to be differently. And this research was really interesting because while the motivation for why people wanted to help was slightly different. In Europe, certainly, we have, you know, a link to a colonial past, et cetera, that, you know, creates a slightly different relationship with our motivation. And in the States, people refer to their motivation being about the founding ideals of the nation and great leadership. The motivations were slightly different. In terms of what people wanted out of the creative concept, they were actually remarkably similar, like surprisingly similar. So that being said, I have been in charge of creating Global Creative in the last year, and I will tell you it's an incredible struggle to create a piece and sort of make that exactly relevant for our different markets. And really the challenge for me is not to always start with the US perspective of that, but to sort of work with our country teams and sort of get their idea of the right narrative. I would say that there is a slight difference in terms of our European and African teams wanting to tell a slightly more complex story, perhaps, because I think they feel that their audiences are more exposed to these issues. I don't know if that's a fair reflection, but that's certainly what we hear from them. Dan, do you want to add to that?
I think that, I mean, some of the research that we've done has pointed out some of the work that the One Campaign's already done, which is languages obviously really matters. So doing it in native language is absolutely essential in a lot of these places. Just assuming that you can throw some subtitles up there and put it on in France doesn't necessarily resonate that well. We found the same thing in China and in other places. It has to be in a native language. So there are those challenges. There is a degree of sophistication in these certain audiences And so, you know, even when I was having a conversation with someone at DFID, they went, you know, the living proof stories were kind of made for an American audience with an American sensibility. And if you come over here, if you don't make a living proof video that has really dry sense of humor, you might find that there'll be a lot of Brits that will stare and not be that impressed. So I do think you have to be sensitive to those things. Even in some of our research, we've known that there are certain values that are different. So in France, for example, social justice is like almost always comes up as the first most important thing. And that you think about how you can connect with certain audiences when you know that social justice is the most important thing. You know from some of our research here in the United States that, like, return on investment is a really important thing, right? We sit around thinking about, for if you invest $2, we save $12 in the long run by educating that child. Those are messages that really resonate in the United States, and not nearly as much, say, in France. So I think there is a real nuance and a difference that has to be considered.
The nice thing about vaccines is that you can have both, because you can talk about how they're one of the most cost-effective interventions, but also that they're a great tool of equity, as the head of UNICEF likes to talk about. The question about the Kony video, I'm just mindful that we want to get to more questions. I don't know, you know, David, if you'd want to address that or any others?
So, sure. Obviously, we could have done the whole day on this one. There have been some amazing discussions on this topic. I would point you to someone who I think is very thoughtful, and what I was amazed at when he wrote this blog post. Ethan Zuckerman is the head of the MIT Civic Media Lab, and he wrote a blog on the Kony video that raised questions about his concerns around it. And what I was really impressed with, though, was the incredibly thoughtful responses that he got from people who pointed out the pros and the cons. I think that you probably get a sense from where I am on this stuff. I think that it's a great example of using the tools that we have. The kind of digital landscape has changed, and the ability to use these tools to kind of talk directly to audiences, to distribute them, and they created a very smart engagement platform. For you knew what you were supposed to do. They had things that they wanted you to do. But remember, they had 2 million, I think, plus Facebook followers before they released this video. I mean, it didn't come out of the blue. They had been building an audience, and they understand how to use these platforms. So that one should see as there's enormous potential there. I also think that, though, back to the authenticity and the credibility matters. What always worries me about this is I've always felt like when I was inside Nightline, If your organizations called me and had a story you wanted to tell, I was far more open to doing that than some PR agency that was working for some corporation, right? I always felt like these are smart people doing really smart work, and they got eyes and ears on the ground, and I'm going to hear what they have to say. When organizations like that don't feel like they have put out propaganda and it feels like it has been a little loose with the facts, I think that hurts all of us. I think that so the next time you try to put out your video, there'll be people who might say, oh, you know, but how much can we trust this in terms of its facts that we say? You know, it's interesting. When ProPublica started, that nonprofit newsroom, the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, and one of the things that they wrote at the beginning, which I thought was really right, is the current landscape is amazing because it's exploded these sources of information, and the distribution channels are wide open, which is great. The challenge is that there seems to be a proliferation of opinions and a shortage of facts. And I think that our ability as organizations to deal in real facts, to be trusted, you can still do your messages and you can still do advocacy, but you have to make sure they're based in facts. When we did the Living Proof efforts, every one of those stories, we fact-checked down to the T, every single story. And because I think that you quickly can lose your place and your credibility if you jeopardize that. So that's just an important one for me.
Well, Dan, thank you. And while we have the mic, if people could raise their hands and the microphones will go around. Roxanne wanted to make a quick point. So if you could raise your hands and the microphones will come to you.
I just actually wanted to come to the second question that I don't think we covered off yet, which was about the image of Africans and how they're portrayed in the Benin documentary that we made. And it was really challenging because we did know by looking at voodoo specifically in Benin, we were looking at a very, very specific thing that was very specific to a country in Africa, and we didn't want that to, you know, suggest the portrayal of all Africa being about voodoo. That being said, we did try to make the heroes in the story, like Dan was talking about, be African heroes. So the guy that you saw talking about Africa, people talk about Africa with no knowledge of Africa. He was a journalist, and he's kind of one of our sort of narrators and heroes throughout the story. So we did try for most of the storytelling to be African-led. We did try to mix in there some science and technology. I think we cut to a laboratory at one point. And we also, you know, we had government in there. We had the health minister talking about what they had done to get the vaccines out there and the coverage that they had gotten. So it's not perfect. And we kept asking ourselves, where are the cell phones? How can we get the cell phones in this story, and really challenging ourselves on that? But we did, it was an African-led story.
Thank you. Well, again, we're so sorry that we have gone into your Q&A time, and we're going to be moving on to the next panel, but let's take a few more questions, and we'll take them together, and then we'll give really short answers. So we have Sally, we have the lady at the back, who I know tried to ask before, and the gentleman over here.
Very quickly, my name is Rosemary Reed. When you were doing the first film, you did meningitis. I really don't know what meningitis does and is. Could you have possibly put even two sentences to say what that is and what it does to children? I think it might have helped everybody for understanding.
Thank you so much for raising that. And that is exactly what the Living Proof version of this video does, because we realize that the social media audience, the advocates, the policymakers for which this version was intended, didn't have that knowledge either. And so we did explain exactly what meningitis is, what the disease burden was, and how it really manifests itself and affected populations throughout Africa.
Yeah, Ken Meyercord, World Docs. I found one thing missing in all the videos, and that was dying babies. I haven't seen the Coney video. For what it's worth, I logged on to it thinking it was 30 seconds long, and when I found out it was 30 minutes, I closed that window pretty quick. But I'm betting that there's some pretty gruesome stuff in there, and sadly, that may be part of its appeal. So I'd be interested in your reasoning in not taking that approach.
And then one last question from Sally.
Hi, Sally Paxton. Some of you touched upon it, but I was wondering, if an organization is looking at doing a video, what are the things that an organization should think about in terms of measurement of success? So, you know, it obviously depends a little bit on what your motivation is, but if you could talk a little bit more about how you measured your own videos as to whether or not they succeeded.
Thank you. I'll say very quickly, we had positive imagery, but we did have language in our video that said a child dies every 20 seconds from vaccine-preventable disease. In terms of the metrics, we are trying to get a certain number of people to sign up online and then take advocacy action, and we have a metric of how many people we have, you know, following us on Facebook. But the email sign-ups are most important, because that's where you can go back and say, could you please send this email to a member of Congress to ask for this specific funding for vaccines, or whatever the ask may be. So those are those two questions. Any other quick thoughts from the other panelists?
I'd like to answer the question about the measurement. And I think one of the important things is that we can get focused on kind of the indicators of success, the likes, the views, but not to lose sight of the ultimate goal. Why did you produce this video? Is it to enact policy change, and really monitoring that tie, that correlation between those two activities? So it's important not to lose sight of that ultimate goal.
Well, thank you all so much. We really appreciate your attention. I'll leave you with a thought I got from old media, which is listening to the radio on a radio today, which said that, instead of online, that YouTube is the third most visited site, and that people on average spend 10 to 15 minutes a day who are on YouTube watching videos. So our goal is to try and get them to think about vaccines. So thank you all very much, and we look forward to the next panel.